Welcome to episode 15. Do you ever find yourself saying, I have a small bladder. My pelvic floor and bladder are so weak. I am always looking for a bathroom. Or, my bladder runs my life. If so, you aren't alone. My guest today is Dr. Jennifer Locke, a certified urologist whose practice consists of a mixture of general and reconstructive urology. It hasn't taken long for me to recognize the passion she has for her area of specialty and how much she values a team approach. Our goal for this episode is to help you understand your overactive bladder, how your brain and pelvic floor are involved, and talk about treatment options that can include collaboration between your family doctor, urologist, and physiotherapist. Listen in as we talk about how evidence supports pelvic floor physiotherapy as the first line of defense, how medications may be helpful, and the role that surgery can play. At the end of the day, what is most important is your quality of life and finding the right fit for you. Now, maybe just have a quick pee before we get started, and then you can get to addressing that problem once you know more after the episode. Welcome to the Pelvic Floor Project. I'm your host, Melissa DeSalles, a physical therapist in Kelowna, BC, Canada, and founder of Mommy Berries, an online platform to support pregnant and postpartum women. I'm here because too many women fear their body during pregnancy and then feel let down by their body after baby, and I want to help change this. My goal with this podcast is to take my personal experience as a mom of two, my knowledge as a PT, and everything I've learned from my clients, and then sit down with other professionals, not only to provide you with evidence-based information, but maybe, just maybe, spark some changes by bringing our professions together. I'm confident we can make some headway if we come together to look at women holistically. I'm curious to see what changes this project will make in my community, and I look forward to have you join me on this journey. A reminder that content in this podcast is intended as general information only and should not be considered medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Now, sit back and relax while you listen. I know this will be difficult for you because you have 3,450 things to do, but I challenge you to put yourself first during this episode. All right, Jen, I am really looking forward to this episode and just talking through how, you know, different healthcare providers, in this case, physio and urologists, might work together to collaborate, you know, in treating clients. So thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to do this.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
And just so everyone that's listening knows, I actually just met Jen virtually this summer. She reached out and said, I'm moving my practice to Kelowna and I'd love to touch base with the pelvic health physios in town. And I thought, awesome. And I'm curious to know, your exposure thus far to our profession. And I mean, you know, obviously in your training or in some of the research that you've done, physios are coming up, and I'm curious to know, that experience for you or that exposure.
That's a great question. So I have done my urology training and residency, and then I've been doing a fellowship in reconstructive or functional urology, which means I see a lot of patients with incontinence and leakage. And, you know, as urologists, we really don't get a significant exposure to pelvic floor physiotherapy, but it is the first line treatment for most of the conditions that I actually treat. So that's why I wanted to reach out to you, because I think it's one of the most important aspects of patients in my population. So that's why I think it's great we can work together to discuss things for our patients, as well as provide options.
Awesome. I wondered if it would make sense if I start with just describing the way that I help my clients understand their brain, their bladder, and their pelvic floor. And so I wonder if I just set the stage by giving a description or a visual of that. And then we start talking about, you know, what conditions or what symptoms might bring people in to see both of us. Does that sound okay?
I think that's great. As you know, the brain and the bladder are definitely related. So, and they work together. So that would be great.
Absolutely. So those of you that are watching via video will see what I'm showing, but otherwise you just have to kind of use your imagination. But I describe the bladder like a balloon. And so if you picture that the bottom of the balloon is pointing down, that the clamp holding the balloon closed would be partially the pelvic floor. So the bladder is a muscle, but a muscle that we don't really have control over. That's our brain's job. And so as the bladder starts to fill, so the muscle starts to stretch, or the walls start to stretch, and the bladder can hold around 2 cups or 500 mils of urine. And as the bladder starts to stretch, there's little receptors in the walls of the bladder that will be sending messages to the brain saying, I'm filling. It'll just notify it that I'm filling. So it's the stretch that notifies the brain. All the while, like I said, the pelvic floor is at the bottom helping to hold closure. There's also another sphincter that we have no control over, but there's two different sphincters down there. And understanding that we have control over the pelvic floor helps people understand how they do have control over this system. But generally, it's something that we don't need to think about. So as the bladder's filling, and as I mentioned, well, let's say it hits around, I picture sometimes a measuring cup. So people understand that it'll hit different levels. And let's say around 150 mils, so less than a cup, you know, the message to the brain will go up and it'll say, you know, I have to pee. But the brain will say, well, it has to collect all the information it's getting from our body and our surroundings and decide what's a priority. And with that little amount to fill, it will decide this isn't a priority. Thanks for letting me know, but continue to fill, bladder. So the bladder will continue to fill. It'll start to send messages up to the brain as it fills more and more with a bit more urgency. So the brain has to still decide, is this a priority to go? And until it gets closer to, I usually say around 400 mils when it's starting to really be, you know, I'm full. That message comes with more urgency. And the brain will start to say, okay, yes, it's time for you to go to the bathroom. You need to find a bathroom. Let's say you're at the mall, walking around the mall, and you think, okay, I know where the bathroom is. I'm going to find the bathroom. And you get there. Meanwhile, you're starting to have that irritated feeling like, I've got to go. And your pelvic floor will be working a bit harder to manage the extra pressure over top. So as the bladder fills, the pelvic floor kind of has to dial up its work to make sure that you don't let anything go. And let's say you get there, there's a lineup. Oh, shoot. I have to wait. You're getting more and more urgency. But again, in a normal functioning system, the brain will be saying, this is not a safe time to go. And your pelvic floor will help ensure that nothing comes out the bottom. It's finally your turn to go into the stall. You go in, you take your pants down, your underwear down, you sit down. And the brain will say, okay, safe. Let's let the bladder empty. So the bladder will tighten, the pelvic floor will let go, and you'll empty and start everything over again. So again, that's in a normal functioning system. But most of you listening are probably struggling with a system that's not optimized. And maybe you're noticing that you can't hold very much urine, or that signal up to your brain is coming with lots of priority all the time. Like that you can't get your bladder off your mind. Maybe you feel like you're going to empty all the time. Maybe you can't empty all the way, or you're leaking. And so that would be something that probably takes you in, you know, your symptoms are starting to bother you. So you go into your family doctor. And before I go into kind of the sequence of events there, Jen, anything to add about that, like, simplified version of anything happening?
I think the version you portrayed is exactly what happens. I think the other thing to bring up is that this commonly happens to people where their bladder does not function properly, but people don't talk about it amongst each other. So that descriptor is really good because you can relate to it, but it happens to more people than you would guess.
Oh, absolutely. And I think for people to understand, like, what would you say? What do you tell your clients? Like, how many times in the day should they expect to go to the bathroom in an ideal situation?
Right. So there is no normal amount that you should be going to the bathroom. It obviously depends on how much fluid you drink during the day. But I agree that the capacity of the bladder, or how much the bladder can fill, is usually about 500 milliliters or 2 cups. Okay, so if you're drinking a lot of fluids, then obviously you're going to be peeing more frequently. But a lot of this this issue of overactive bladder is really how much it affects your quality of life and what you do on a daily basis. Is it affecting your ability to go out? Are you always thinking about the next bathroom? Are you not able to exercise because you're concerned that you're going to get leakage? Those are the things that are really what bring patients to me.
Exactly. And I think that that's what I often ask people, what brings you in now? And generally it's, well, yeah, this has been bothering me for a while, but something about it is really moved up on my priority list. And so I think I'm guessing that they'll present to their family doctor first. And I wonder, I know that's not your specialty, but I wonder if you could touch on what someone might be able to expect from their family doctor. What different things might they look at?
Right. So I think definitely the family doctor is the first person you should be talking to about this, if it's affecting your quality of life. I think the role of the family doctor is to make sure that there's nothing bad going on. For example, if you have blood in your urine, if you have infections causing it. And if we find that those things are not happening, then it really becomes the family doctor teaching you how to manage your symptoms. And I think you are very versatile in terms of behavioral modifications and things and pelvic floor physiotherapy, first line options for these symptoms. So just to go back a bit, what symptoms are we looking at? Usually it's, you know, I have to go, but I'm not going to get to the bathroom in time. That's the most common symptom. And then frequency. So someone's going to the washroom it can be every 30 minutes, but even someone going to the washroom every hour, 2 hours could be bothersome to them. And then there's also the question if you're getting up at night to pee, and that's also within this spectrum of this condition. If you're going, it's, you know, you're getting up and then you can't go back to sleep, that's also an important component to address. So the family doctor's role is really to make sure that there's nothing bad going on, but then also trying first line treatment options or management options for your bladder. A healthy bladder is a happy bladder, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe exactly. You could talk about those.
Yeah. So that's what I would love. Cause I think that this is what I think happens a lot of times in the system. This is my perspective, is that often clients or patients are sent to, you know, wait for a urologist before they're sent to a physio. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this episode, is because there, like you said, there is a lot of research suggesting that pelvic floor physio is a great place to start there, and the research supports that. But I think people have this misunderstanding that we just teach Kegels, and I'll just kind of describe what I talk about with my clients, and then maybe it'll kind of clear that up. But when someone comes in, just like you mentioned, they'll describe those symptoms that you went through, and I will go through the visual I just described. And then often I describe to them that how we're going to come into that system is think about the brain, because the brain is very changeable and it just gets into patterns and habits. And so much of an overactive bladder or a bladder that's bothering you all the time comes down to habits that we have. Because I think a lot of people believe that they have a small bladder. I have a lot of people coming in saying, I have a small bladder, or I have a weak bladder. But them understanding, I said, very few people anatomically have a small bladder, but that it will start to behave small. Because we have control over that system. And if when our bladder, let's say early on in the filling process, we get that bit of urge, you know, you can get that urge when you've just gone to the bathroom. But the brain should usually say not full yet, but sometimes we'll do a just in case pee, or, you know, right before I go, or I'm going by the toilet, it's convenient right now, I should go. And so we kind of teach that brain to prioritize the bladder message all the time so that we're emptying more often. And so I think what happens is that message goes up to the brain with more and more priority, and the brain gets used to responding to it. And I always tell people to think of, you know, when you take your kids shopping and you just want them to be quiet, so you buy them a toy, but then really quickly, every single time they go to the store, they want a toy, and you think, what have I done? You know, but it's kind of how the brain and the bladder work, is that if you constantly empty when you have that urge, you're going to start to notice that kid cries more and more when they go to the store, because they know they'll get that toy, right? So that's one of the first things I want people to understand, and that's one of the pieces that we're going to be targeting, is the behavior aspect. And so what I'll often do is I'll send them home the first time with a bladder diary, because we're so going to the bathroom is such an automatic thing. We don't really think about it. And so sometimes I want them to see what they are doing before they make a change. So I'll just say, fill it out for 3 or 4 days. I don't usually get them to measure it right away. I just say, like, count how many seconds your pee is, small, medium, or large. Just notice, are you going more at home or more at work? I just want them to notice their tendencies. And then I also explain to them that the other aspect we have control over is the pelvic floor. And as I mentioned, a lot of people believe that they just have a weak pelvic floor and therefore they can't hold the urine in. But I think a lot of people are surprised to know that the pelvic floor, I would say, is rarely simply weak. Often it's holding on to a bit more tension. So it's kind of a little bit more active than it needs to be in the day. And that can be for different reasons. Sometimes it can be related to stress. Sometimes it can be related to the fact that you feel you're going to leak all the time. So you instinctively hold more tension down there. Sometimes it can be from tight hips. Like, there's so many different things that we'll hold a bit more tension. But if that pelvic floor is working harder than it needs to all day, you don't necessarily have the trust when you need to go really bad. And so I generally want to also address that external sphincter or the pelvic floor so that they understand, what does it feel like to relax those muscles? What does it feel like to tighten those muscles? How can I help the system when I need to? Because it's like, we need to have some sense of control first, don't we? Before. And so those are the two things that I would say to describe to them that we're going to come at the system. And I think it depends on the person where I start, but I generally send them home with pelvic floor awareness. I want you to feel what it feels like to tighten versus relax. I want you to start noticing your habits on the toilet. Do you relax your pelvic floor and let the bladder fully empty? Or do you find that you're still holding tension and maybe you have some residual volume left after? But a lot of that first couple sessions is an awareness and gaining some control. But I'm going to throw it back to you now, because again, I find that's what I would love to see, is that we are able to address these things maybe a bit earlier for people, because generally what I see is they're coming in saying, I've been told that I need to do physio or surgery, or I've been started on these medications and I don't find that they're working, or they worked for a while and they don't work anymore. And so I would really love to hear your take on that, because I absolutely understand that physio itself isn't going to necessarily address everybody's symptoms completely, and that there are different options out there. But I wonder if you can speak a little to, let's say someone makes it to you, whether it be, you know, after seeing a physio or before. I'm curious to know which other treatment options you discuss with them.
Right. So in terms of referrals, I often get patients that have leakage that bothers or affects their quality of life. And that's the main thing. The first thing, my role is to actually determine what type of leakage it is. Because as you know, today we're talking about overactive bladder, but there are different types of leakage that can happen. You know, in some people, you can have leakage and you don't even know what's happening. And that's called unconscious leakage. In some people, you can have leakage when you're exercising specifically, or when you're coughing and sneezing. And then in other patients, you can get this urgency, this frequency and urgency, and that can lead to leakage. You can also get urgency with no leakage, but the urgency also affects your quality of life. So it's my job to really get to know the patient as well as what type of incontinence it is. And again, you, Melissa, talked about the bladder diary, and I think the voiding diary is a very good tool. The only other thing I would add to it is I also like to know what you're drinking. Mm-hmm. You know, are you drinking a lot of caffeine? Are you drinking a lot of juice? Are you drinking a lot of water, alcohol? Because that helps determine, because really water is the safest thing for your bladder. So I think it's good to get that information in the bladder diary as well. So with that information, The reason why I want to know what type of leakage it is because the treatments are different. So if you have leakage with cough, sneeze, exercise, that is truly pelvic floor physiotherapy, as you can imagine, and Kegel exercises. But the next step would possibly be a surgical approach, whereas bladder overactivity isn't necessarily a surgical treatment. It's really, we generally focus after behavioral modifications on medications, for example. And in terms of the, so we'll talk specifically about urgency with leakage. I think first line, as you talked about, is really behavioral modifications and, you know, the conditioning situation. So sometimes we offer therapy such as distraction therapy. So when you feel like that urge to pee, you find some way to, say, put pressure on your foot to distract you from that moment, to get you away from that moment when you're waiting in line for the bathroom, right? We know that the brain is involved because I've been involved in studies where we can see that the brain acts differently in patients that have overactive bladder when they feel that urgency. So we know we have to retrain the brain in that way. The other behavior thing is that, as I alluded to, water is really good for your bladder, but spicy foods, caffeine, alcohol, juices are not so good for your bladder. They can actually irritate the lining of the bladder and make you feel like you have to pee more often. I'm not saying you should eliminate them from your diet. I'm just saying being cognizant of how much of those drinks you're actually bringing into your diet. And then your true question was, what are the options for patients with overactive bladder? And so there are medication options and there are after that surgical options available. Okay. Do you want me to get into the details of the medication?
Yes, I would love to hear. I would love to hear kind of when you would start someone and what that looks like. Absolutely. And as we go, I'll shoot you some more questions because I know some of the ones that I would love to have covered, but I think if you just start, that would be great.
Perfect. So in terms of medications for the bladder, again, this is in terms of overactive bladder, this is all for quality of life. So no one is needing to take a medication. It's really the medications are used to help you with your quality of life. And so there are a couple of medications you can take by mouth that are available. There's two classes. There's one class called anticholinergics or antimuscarinics. And these really inhibit the overactive bladder muscle. So they stop the muscle from actually contracting, okay? And these are drugs like trospium, Tobias. There are a multitude of these drugs. There's another class called beta-3 agonists. And instead of inhibiting the contraction, they promote the muscle to relax, okay? And there's only one drug available in Canada, and that's called Mirbetric or Mirbegron. Now, with these medications, They're not, usually patients go on them for about, 4 weeks to about 3 months to see if they actually help. It is something you can take in the short term to see if they help with your symptoms. But if they do help, you can take them for a very long time as well. But every medication has side effects. So I know that about a third of the patients I put on a medication will probably not, or a third will remain on the medication a year later, but two thirds will actually come off the medication, either because it doesn't work or because of the side effects. And I think that the medications work really well. So it's mainly side effects. With the anticholinergics, it can cause dry mouth. It can cause constipation, dry eyes. And so those are things to think about. So if you already have issues with cavities or you already have dry mouth, you don't want to try one of those medications. Whereas the beta-3 agonist, the Mirbetric, the main side effect is if you have uncontrolled high blood pressure, it can make that worse, but that's very rare. Usually I recommend a trial of the beta-3 agonist. That's the one that promotes the relaxation, purely because the side effect profile is better. But more importantly, there have been some studies recently to show that there's some correlation or a relationship between the anticholinergics and dementia or cognition. So when you hear that, you don't really want to go on a medication that can cause you to have loss of memory. So I think I usually try a patient on Mirbetric for 4 weeks to 3 months to see if that helps with symptoms. But again, I'm not saying that you need to go on a medication. I'm saying it is an option for you. And we know in clinical trials that it does help many patients. And it could be something for the short term. For example, you're just so bothered, you just need a break from your symptoms. You take it for 3 months and then you go off of it. And that's okay, right?
Do you find that you tend to want them to try some of the behavior changes or, you know, some of the pelvic floor work before you try the medication? Or do you like them to be started simultaneously for best practice? Or what do you tend to do?
I think with any medication you take, there are side effects associated with it. So I definitely recommend behavioral modifications, pelvic floor physiotherapy, before trying the medication. Because, you know, I think you can gain a lot of benefit from just reducing the irritants in your diet and learning and being more cognizant of your pelvic floor and understanding how it works. Mm-hmm. Than taking a medication. But the medications are still quite good for patients that still have symptoms despite being on these behavioral modifications. Mm-hmm. But I definitely think you should try the behavioral modifications first.
And so generally, as a physio, if I'm sent someone, you know, to try some of the tools that I have in my toolbox, and we're just not seeing the results that work for them, their quality of life is still not improved enough. Should my go-to then, I think probably what I would tend to do, especially if they haven't seen a urologist yet, is I might send a note back to the family doctor saying, this is what we've tried. And will the family doctors prescribe those medications, or does that need to come from a urologist?
So good question. I think that, I think it's important that as family doctors and urologists, we collaborate in the same way that we collaborated, pelvic floor physiotherapists and urologists and family doctors. I think many family doctors are quite comfortable prescribing these medications and know the side effects. So I think it's fine to give it a try with a family doctor. But I think my role really comes in if a patient has more complex health issues, or if a patient has tried these medications and behavioral therapies and they're still quite plagued by their overactive bladder, then, you know, there are other options that I would go through as a urologist for patients. And then the other thing is to have an objective lens to make sure there's nothing else going on, for example, infections or other reasons as to why the bladder is behaving that way, for example. So if patients are on medications through their family doctor and they're finding that either they can't tolerate them or that their symptoms are just unbearable, and even if they have a slight benefit from the medication, but it's not enough, then I think I'm happy to see, because, you know, there are different medications you could try. You could try combination medications. And then there are surgeries that are available that are a little bit higher on the risk list, but they're still useful. One is cystoscopy, which is looking inside the bladder with injections of Botox. Okay. And so that's used for a lot of other health issues, but Botox is probably the best treatment available for overactive bladder in clinical trials. So that's something that a urologist like myself would be administering for patients. This is something that you do, say, every 3 months to a year, but many patients have a very good result with Botox.
Is this something they have to pay for out of pocket, Jen?
Right. That's a good question. So in terms of payment in British Columbia, there is some coverage, but you have to meet very specific guidelines. For example, you have to have tried an oral medication for a certain period of time and failed that treatment, for example. And then some people's plans do pay for Botox, but you have to go through hoops in order to try Botox and have it covered.
Okay.
There is one other treatment option surgically. Well, there's two. There's PTNS and sacral neuromodulation, and they're both sort of pacemaker type treatments. We don't offer PTNS, unfortunately, in British Columbia at this time, or sacral neuromodulation, but I know that there are groups that are trying to advocate for patients, because patients have to go to Alberta for this, or Ontario, and some patients end up doing that, but it is quite far to go. The thing that is quite important to know is that if patients have leakage of stool or bowel bowel movements at the same time as urgency incontinence, then sacral neuromodulation is a very good treatment for those patients. So it is something that is available in Canada, but it's not first line treatment.
Awesome. I think that's great. I think that the goal of this episode was just to basically talk about those clients that are experiencing more that, you know, that urge, my bladder's on my brain constantly, I'm always searching for the bathroom, and just to give them an idea of some of the options out there, because I can imagine it very much affects their quality of life. And this definitely gives me some ideas for future episodes to talk about different surgical interventions or to talk about different symptoms that people experience. But I think that we've really captured this population quite well, unless there's anything else that you feel like I've missed, Jen.
No, I think the only emphasis I would say is I agree, Melissa, that the first line therapies, behavioral modifications, and physiotherapy are probably the most important component of dealing with overactive bladder up front. And it's very successful in some patients. So that's definitely the area I think we should be focusing on for these patients.
Yeah. And I think that the more I work in this area, the more I see how empowering it is to people to feel they have a sense of control of their system. Cause I think otherwise, you know, sometimes we have this belief that the surgery or the medication will just take that away. But, you know, our brain and our body are quite powerful in being able to make changes. And the more that we're aware of our body, I think, how can that be harmful, right? Just to understand how it works for us and how we have some control over that whole system.
I think that's important.
Yeah, I really look forward to you being here and working back and forth. And I love this collaboration. And thank you again so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show.
And that's a wrap. I hope you've enjoyed the episode and have taken something valuable away. Please take the time to rate and review the podcast. And if you'd like more information about my online program to support women during pregnancy, birth prep, and postpartum recovery, check out my website, mommyberries.com. I'll see you next time.